This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in a hotel.
216 people, he says, were recently brought to this hotel in Methuen to live.
Without warning, the state relocated 107 people in need of shelter and assistance to this Kingston hotel.
Two hotels, actually, in two Massachusetts towns, and thanks there to WCVB for the sound from last month. Now, Massachusetts is required by law to house families with children under 21 and pregnant people. Hotels and motels are a last resort, but dozens of families arrived in hotels and motels in Kingston, Plymouth, and Methuen with literal or no warning from the state to the towns in the last few weeks. Since then, local organizations have been working furiously to help every way they can, and today we're going to check in with Kingston and Methuen. Working in Kingston, Suzanne or Sue Giovanetti, the chief executive officer of the Plymouth Area Coalition for the Homeless, and Gerald Gabot, the executive director of Immigrant Family Services Institute. And in Methuen, Carl Howell, he is the chief program officer for Community Teamwork. Sue, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Gerald, thanks for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be with you.
And Carl, hello.
Hello. So, good morning, and thank you.
Good morning, Carl, and I'm going to start with you. 55 families in a hotel in Methuen a little over 2 weeks ago. How are those families?
The families are settled in. We have wraparound services there. We stood up, were able to stand up a team, very quickly to provide wraparound services and support those families getting, engaged in school systems and getting kind of stabilized.
So wraparound services means help with school, food, the search for housing, work permits, et cetera. Is that right, Carl?
Exactly. Everything. I mean, we take every family, we meet with them individually to assess what their needs are, and then we try to connect with community providers, local municipalities and school systems to meet those needs.
So, Sue, you're working in Kingston. The state sent more than 100 people there. How are they holding up?
They're doing wonderful, really. I think we're going through the intakes with each of the families. At our site, we have 36 families, They're doing great. I think they're very optimistic, and we've had several rehousing meetings already with families that are really eager to find their own place and get into a self-sustainable situation.
And Sue, I understand that the needs have been so much that you're living in the hotel right now to be able to be responsive and supportive. Is that right?
Well, I'm not living here, but I've been spending quite a bit of time here for sure.
I see. Thank you. And Gerald, your organization has been helping coordinate services for Haitian families. In particular, we've had, white supremacists in the parking lot in the last few days at this hotel in Kingston. How are the families you're working with holding up?
I mean, they are just holding on because, again, it is such a very difficult and scary time for them. Difficult in so many ways because, again, when they are placed in a hotel and you're talking about families with children, you're talking about pregnant women, we're talking about, access to food. One of the pregnant women told me, I need my rice and beans so that I can get my medicine. So, and having, the presence of those white supremacists, around the hotel has been also a real challenge for them because they don't know exactly who those people are. They are afraid whether or not it's ICE or it's immigration. They are afraid. And it was such a
they don't know what's going on out there, and they're afraid of who they might be. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're speaking with Carl Howell in Methuen. We have Sue Giovanetti and Gerald Gabot in Kingston. These are the families that have been relocated there by the state. I want to comb out some of the basic understanding people need to have here. So the three of you can check me as we go along. So the state is legally obligated for families with children under the age of 21 or pregnant people. Hotels and motels are the last resort. When that is necessary, however, the state finds a hotel or motel, they move the people there under emergency situations, which means sometimes they do not notify the city or town. But organizations like yours, perhaps, have contracts with the Department of Health and Community Development to respond immediately and provide services. So, A, am I correct on all of that? Carl.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, that is pretty correct. I mean, I can't speak to the communications that the state has with cities and municipalities, but all the rest of it is pretty accurate.
And Sue, did you have advanced warning in your organization in Kingston that families were coming?
So I would say the way you commented earlier was our experience. I mean, we were aware. We received a call and were asked if we could embrace the management of the hotel, and we were glad to be able to do that and put together the services.
And my understanding, Gerald, is that families... Okay, let me backtrack. I understand, you know, immediately that families deserve and want their privacy. My understanding is that this unique situation where this has been reported in the news, there's been the white supremacist presence, et cetera, has created kind of a fishbowl effect for many of the families that's putting undue additional stress on them. Is that fair, Gerald?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And again, when you are here to a new country, you do not really know anyone, you do not speak the language, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where you hear noises, and then it's about you not being welcome and that you need to go back home. Those are very hurtful comments that just add more to the stress of the families are facing. And I have to say that we've been working closely with the state around, you know, finding places, and it's been a challenge for them to really identify places. And sometimes, depending on how many people that they have, they are making phone calls and at the last minute, you know, find that, you know, X place is available and Y place is available. So that is why it's sometimes not just, I'm not defending the state, but I know that sometimes it's hard for them to really do all of the preliminary work in terms of connecting with the community to let them know those people are coming.
So picking up on that point, Gerald, about not, you know, you said you're not defending the state, but this is a hard and complex situation. Let's go there for a minute. And there are two subjects as we look at what it takes to be responsive to and support the families who are facing homelessness, have been relocated to hotels and motels in Methuen and Kingston, the two communities we're focusing on today. Two big kind of question marks out there are housing and schools. Housing, I think, is the biggest and most gnarly, so we're gonna get to that, but I want to touch on schools for a second first. Sue, there are certain obligations that the state has for kids who are being shuffled around because they're experiencing homelessness, but have a home school district. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The McKinney-Vento law provides for children to return to the community to attend school from where they went homeless. So the community they were living in, they do have the right to go back to that community, even if they've been displaced because they've lost their home.
So I'm just making up this example, Sue, but we'll use Methuen and Kingston. If a family became homeless in Methuen and has been housed in a hotel or motel in Kingston, as long as it's considered in the best interest of the child, that child has the right to continue to go to school in Methuen.
That's correct. As long as I believe there's a, and I can't say this 100%, but I believe there's, you know, as long as it's not more than an hour transport, I believe there's some, there's a qualification there, but that's absolutely right.
And the families, Carl, actually have the right to transportation. Sue's just talking about, you know, there's a reasonable distance involved, but part of the services that have to be provided is transportation to for families if their children are going to continue to go to school in the home district. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Again, along the lines with the time stuff, but yeah, the two school districts work out the arrangements, whether the new school district will absorb the family and the education components, or whether they'll do transportation.
Okay, so that's sort of the rights and responsibilities around kids and schooling. Carl, in Methuen, where your organization, Community Teamwork, is working, do you have a sense of how many kids in those 55 families are actually, who should be in school right now, are actually in school right now?
The last number that I heard, we had
roughly 31 of the 53 families enrolled and set up. We were just kind of working out some of the paperwork to get the rest settled.
So I'm trying to get my head, Gerald, around this idea that you have a kid who, mm-hmm. who from a social-emotional standpoint, really needs some consistency, right? Everything mm-hmm. in their life has been thrown up in the air. And mm-hmm. now they're experiencing homelessness under a really bizarre microscope. And with a Haitian family potentially facing additional confusion and fear around status, immigration, et cetera. And now the kids' day-to-day education really may be disrupted. Talk about the impact on a kid from that and what we can and should be doing better in order to provide, you know, better educational support, but just that ecosystem of stability for kids.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's especially, and you know, we have different groups of people seeking refuge here. And for the Haitian families, I mean, I have to say, ten times more stressful on them. The reason why is so many of our children, and that's one of the big issues that we are facing, so many of our children who are here with us have been, you know, on this itinerary, this journey for years, sometimes 2 years, sometimes 3 years. It means that they have not been in school for a long time. Now that they are here with us, we need some stability for them so that they know that they are in a school system where they are learning, where they are trying to, you know, bridge the gap, because the learning losses for those children is very, very high. And that means for us as a community, we need to be thinking about what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years when those kids are ready to go to high school and they will need to go to college with so much learning loss. So we need to do better in terms of, you not only, especially for families with children, to really find them, not just a temporary place, but a permanent place where they can go to school. So just quickly, somebody approached me to go and, you know, register a child to a school in Kingston. My question is that, for how long are they going to be in Kingston? Because I do not want them to go to school for 2 or 3 days in Kingston, then have to be again moved to another place. So that's a real, real challenge for families, and the impact of on our children is really, really, really great.
So it would be better off for them overall to be out of school for a few days rather than moved 1, 2, 3 times over a short period while you're settling housing.
Exactly, especially with the language barriers, with the cultural differences. I'm talking about children who are, for the first time, are going to be in a school. And most of the communities where they are, you will see it's probably 1 or 2 black children in that classroom. So we don't want to add more burden on those children. And that's the reason why we are working really diligently to see, can we quickly in the next day or so find a permanent place for them so that they can be in a school where they know they're going to spend the whole year instead of moving from one to the next.
We're speaking with Gerald Gabot and Sue Giovanetti in Kingston and Carl Howell about Methuen here as we look at the on-the-ground response for families who were, at least for the cities and towns, surprisingly moved to hotels and motels after experiencing homelessness. And we've been hearing quite a bit about those families in Methuen, Kingston, and Plymouth in the last few weeks. So, Sue, I want to move to the housing piece now, because many needs for the families. Some of these families are fairly new to the country. Some have been in the state for a long time. Their status doesn't matter in terms of the state's obligations to them if they have kids under 21 or are pregnant people. At the core, in some way, in some important way, Sue, this is a housing story, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, I mean, you know, as an EA shelter, first and foremost, our job is to help families that come into shelter.
Excuse me, EA is emergency assistance, is that right?
That's correct.
Sorry,
yes,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our job is to help them identify self-sustainable housing, certainly with the assistance of home-based funds if they qualify for those. But the lack of affordable housing is very challenging when we get into the rehousing conversation. But that said, I will say that, you know, in our experience with the population that we're serving in the hotel right now, They have been, they've dug right in. They've only been here a week and a half, almost 2 weeks, and they've really dug in and are starting to explore what is possible for them, for the immigrant population within the shelter. We need to make sure that all of their immigration papers are settled and that they're lined up for Mass Health, and that we have all of those pieces taken care of, and then we dig in and start the housing conversation.
So, Carl, the Baker administration's written a letter to the federal government, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, asking for support on several fronts, including clarity about status, expediting work permits, more money. Will those things help if, at its core, we just don't have enough affordable housing in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Yes and no. I do think that those things will help. They'll help organizations like ours provide as much support as we can and leverage those resources to help these families transition. However, to Sue's point, the country is so far behind in housing production and creating not only just affordable housing but just housing period. That it's really challenging for us to find appropriate housing for the families that do come into this program. Historically, we used to be able to, I would say, the higher percentage of families that were placed into fair market rents. Over the pandemic, we've only been able to move families out into units using vouchered or subsidized housing. And that's just a strong point of showing like the lack of affordable housing that exists and the rising costs due to the supply and demand. We really need to change policy and leverage resources to develop more housing so that these families and the families that are coming behind them that are rent burdened and kind of at risk have a safety net or a place that they can move into. At the current kind of compensation wages for their employment or their fixed income that they're on.
All right. Carl Howell is the Chief Program Officer for Community Teamwork, which has been providing services to families residing in a hotel in Methuen. And we've also had Sue Giovanetti, the Chief Executive Officer of Plymouth Area Coalition for the Homeless, and Gerald Gabeau, the Executive Director of Immigrant Family Services Institute, both providing support in Kingston. You must be incredibly busy. I appreciate you taking out the time today to tell us about that experience and help us understand what's happening on the ground there a little bit better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Are you having a harder time getting out of bed these days?
So for me, the hardest part is always getting out of bed in the morning and getting on with my day. It's pitch black, your alarm goes off, and your first thought is, not today, Satan.
So that's TikTok user Chloe Biohacks there talking about seasonal affective disorder or SAD. And with daylight saving time ending this weekend, that means sunset, by the way, at 4:31 p.m. It is the focus of this installment of Be Well, where we talk about your health and ours. So joining us now, Michelle de Blasi, Dr. Michelle de Blasi, psychiatrist and chief of patient psychiatry at Tufts Medical Center, and Howard Brown, social worker with the Boston Public Health Commission, who works within the Boston Public School System. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Howard, welcome to you here in Studio 2 as well.
Thank you very much.
So I want to set the table here. According to the American Academy of Family Physicians, about 4% of Americans have severe seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, and as many as 20% might have milder forms. So, Michelle, let's just start with the basics. What exactly is seasonal affective disorder?
You know, seasonal affective disorder really is when somebody gets depressed, and it's based off of a seasonal pattern. Typically, it happens late fall to early winter when you start noticing that every year you seem to get depressed, have increasing fatigue, trouble concentrating, feeling more hopeless. So it can last, too, for the whole winter time, so up to 4 or 5 months.
So I want to clarify there, too. You're talking about depression, clinical or diagnosed depression here, Michelle. I don't want to make light of people who have a little bit of winter blues. I think many of us do. But we are talking in this case about a seasonal actual depression that coincides with it getting darker, et cetera. Is that right?
That's right, you know, but not to say that some people can't, you know, have a more milder version as well. But, you know, there's a whole range of severity.
And I do want to take this point to say, if you or a loved one is having a mental health crisis, there's a resource available to you. It's the Suicide and Crisis Hotline at 988. Again, you can dial 988. So, Howard, I want to turn to you.
Yes.
We are so aware of increasing anxiety, depression among kids, especially coming out of COVID. Talk about the added aspect of seasonal affective disorder. Is it something we see in kids and young people in our schools?
Well, it's something that we certainly have witnessed. The times often when we have students coming in and talking about feeling sad or being depressed, that can be a variety of things that are going on. And also one of the things to keep in mind with sad is that it's described, I think, in the ICD as being a recurrent depressive disorder, meaning that it comes and it can come and go on a certain degree of severity, almost like on a spectrum. So for some students, there may be a variety of things that they're dealing with. I think when the seasons change and they are exposed to the change of daylight, et cetera, that is just one more thing among a series of things that can affect how a student is feeling or a teenager is feeling.
And an ICD is basically a classification book of illnesses, right?
It's international category of disease.
Classification of diseases, I think. Yeah. Thank you. So I want to bring now, we reached out to our listeners for their thoughts on seasonal affective disorder. That's people who joined our texting club. And if you would like to join our texting club, you can get started by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. Michelle James in Gloucester wrote, "I find pathologizing language harmful here. We aren't disordered for feeling sad when it's dark and cold. It's hard." So does he have a point, Michelle? And what is the conversation you want us as a psychiatrist to be having around seasonal affective disorder?
You know, I think that's right. I think, you know, oftentimes we do have sort of a tendency to sort of over-pathologize things. But I think the point is when you're starting to get to the point where you're so depressed that you're really not functioning, that's really where it's most concerning. You know, when you're having trouble getting out of bed in the morning, maybe even having thoughts of suicide, those things absolutely need to be addressed immediately, whether it's going to the emergency department or talking to your doctor. But it certainly doesn't discount that there is a range, you know, of mild to severe. So if you're feeling depressed, you should be reaching out, you know, to your provider to try to get checked out and get assessed.
We're speaking with psychiatrist Michelle de Blasi of Tufts Medical Center and social worker Howard Brown of the Boston Public Health Commission in our Be Well segment about seasonal affective disorder. So, Howard, you talked about the complicating factors that kids might be facing. We had another text from Jane in Scituate who asks, "Is there any correlation between folks who have seasonal affective disorder and folks who have difficult relationships with the holidays due to various family traumas, dysfunction, et cetera?" Can you talk about that complicating factor?
That is a very good question. And I think it's, again, one of those multiple layers that we deal with. I think for many people, the holidays can be difficult, either due to family dynamics or they lost someone recently. I mean, especially with the pandemic, with having lost so many family members, the holidays can be difficult. So it's one of the many things that seems to be layered on when someone's feeling sad. It's not... It becomes a challenge for people just to be able to get up and move around and do things. And the holidays certainly do add to that.
So, Michelle, let's start talking about how to help. If somebody, if you love someone that you think, whether it's a young person, Howard, or Michelle, an adult, somebody who may be experiencing seasonal affective disorder, what's the first step to take?
You know, I think the first step is recognizing that there's a problem and then reaching out for help. So whether, you know, that's to your primary care doctor or your psychiatrist or somebody, you know, that you're working with, your therapist, to let them know that you're having trouble. I think the first, you know, step is to make sure that there's nothing medically going on, you know, that, for example, checking your thyroid to make sure you have good function there, checking your vitamin D levels, because those can lead to signs of depression. So those are sort of the biggest first steps of what to do.
And Howard, you know, I'm mindful that with kids, and I guess I'm thinking about adolescents because mine mm-hmm. are closest to that age, but kids in general, they may not tell you what they're feeling and they're experiencing, and they need the help of adults. So if you've got a parent or a teacher who's listening to mm-hmm. this and says, I'm concerned maybe there's a kid who's experiencing depression that's seasonal here, how to recognize those signs and how do you approach a kid?
Well, one of the things I think is important, the advantage of working in a school system is that students over time will recognize who you are and may approach you on their own. It's excellent that staff are willing to I've often had staff come up and say, look, I have a concern about this student. Can you meet with them? When they come in and they meet with me, it's very, I treat it as being not informal, but very relaxed and give them an opportunity to talk. Most students are very good about that, especially if they think it's not going to be shared with the general public. Confidentiality thing is pivotal, especially in a school environment where everybody knows everybody else. So it's not unheard of where we'll have, numerous people in many of the schools I've worked with in the past come to me, anything from the administrative assistant to the principal to teachers to the students themselves to friends. And I think that's being based in a school has been a great advantage. Sometimes the kids don't know what's going on, why they're feeling this way, and it's a chance for them to just kind of process what's going on. I often say to them, I don't have the answers. I just ask the questions, and working together, we'll figure that out and then take it from there.
So, Michelle, I'll come back to you as we talk about seasonal affective disorder here on Radio Boston. So we've talked about the first step. Are there any steps people can take for themselves, whether it's fitness or it's their exposure to light or it's hobbies or, you know, what steps can people take to try to mitigate the effect that this change in season, especially this darkness that we have here in New England, where I understand seasonal affective disorder can be a little more prevalent? What steps can people take at home?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually all of those things you listed could potentially be helpful. I mean, in an ideal world, right, we would be able to go on vacation or, you know, potentially even move to some of the lower latitudes where there's more sunlight. But, you know, that's just not always feasible. So doing things like, you know, trying to stay active, exercising, having a healthy diet, like I said, making sure you have a normal vitamin D level. Those are going to be really important things. You should also consider talking to your doctor about potentially getting a light box. So if you can't get away, they do sell light boxes, which you use pretty much 30 minutes in the morning and is basically a simulation of light that can help with this. But again, I would talk to your doctor first before, you know, going ahead and purchasing one of those.
And our producer, Sydney Bowles, looked on Amazon, for example. Those prices can range anywhere from $30 to $300, mm-hmm. depending on what you get. Howard, any additional thoughts on how to stave this off or help support yourself?
Well, I think it's important to reach out to people that you feel care for you and be supportive. It's interesting because I just had a conversation with a school nurse early today about the idea of utilizing light boxes in the school for students who feel that they may benefit from it. In some countries, they have light rooms. Scandinavia, I think, is big on having light rooms for students. But I think emphasizing that this is not a negative, as in there's something wrong with them, letting them know that it's okay that this is what's going on, but to get help when they're out there on their own. I think for some students it can be pretty difficult because they may not be able to differentiate between what might be a symptom of sad versus what's going on at school. But you also have to keep in mind, we're talking about adolescents who are developmentally going through so many changes.
Yeah.
And with all those changes, you pile on sad, you pile on the challenges of school, and you pile on the results of what's been going on with the pandemic. And not every adolescent's going to have difficulty, but there are going to those who are going to have some challenges. But I think it's important for them to recognize that that's, for lack of a better description, normal, and that there are people out there that can help them.
Last thoughts from you, Michelle de Blasi. And we know it's a thing. We understand now better how to recognize the signs, that it's seasonal, what some of the home supports might be. Your last thought for people?
You know, my last thought for people is just reach out for help, you know, to your loved ones, to your providers. Don't be alone in this. I think a lot of people can feel really isolated and just feel really alone. And I think that's the key thing, is reaching out for help. And so that you can start to feel better and not feel so isolated.
All right. Michelle de Blasi is a psychiatrist and chief of inpatient psychiatry at Tufts Medical Center. And Howard Brown is a clinical social worker with the Boston Public Health Commission, who works within the Boston Public School System. Michelle, Howard, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, if you or a loved one are experiencing a mental health crisis or suicidal thoughts, you can call the National Suicide and Crisis Hotline at 988. That's 988. And we always want to hear from you, whether it's Be Well or other segments. If you haven't joined our texting group yet, please do. I'd love to hear from you. You can get started by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. All right, have a little quiz for you. So listen here and tell me, can you name the person who wrote this?
Every individual is born equal in rights with his contemporary. It is the living, not the dead, that are to be accommodated. When man ceases to be, his power and his wants cease with him. Governments have no rights, only duties to their citizens.
So who'd you guess? So here's the answer, Thomas Paine. And that excerpt is from Rights of Man, Part the First. When you think of the founders of this nation, is Paine on the list, top of the list? There at all? Well, Ian Ruskin, actor and writer of the one-man show to begin the world again, The Life of Thomas Paine, is hoping to change the way we think about Paine and his place in history and his place in America. Earlier this week, we sat down with Ian Ruskin and with Thomas Patterson. Patterson's the Bradley Professor of Government and Press at the Harvard Kennedy School and is introducing a live performance of the show at the Boston Public Library tonight. And when we sat down, I started by asking Ian Ruskin whether he wrote the play in defense of Thomas Paine.
I think I am defending him to some extent. I probably wouldn't have written it if I didn't admire him. I do think he's extremely misunderstood in really all history, American history, but also European history. And I'm always attracted to men who are misunderstood and misused, if you like. So he's misunderstood in terms of his position as a founding father. He's often misunderstood by political groups within America today. And it's my aim to try and right that balance a little bit. I consider him a very important founding father.
So, Tom, let's pick up on that thread, and I'm going to play a little bit of sound for you here from the show.
So let me begin by saying that the rumors of my addiction to alcohol were a lie. As to me being a filthy little atheist, filthy? No. Untidy? I grant you. Little? Obviously not. An atheist? Never. Not that I am without my faults, as I'm sure you will discover tonight, but I have been much maligned, misused, and misunderstood by our United States.
So that picks up on what Ian was just saying, and I also confess, as I was watching the play, I realized I don't really think about Thomas Paine at all. And that's quite striking.
I think it is quite striking. I mean, Thomas Paine was one of the most important figures in the American Revolution. Washington said that Paine did more than any other person to get people enlisted and willing to fight the British. Paine's problem was that he was always a revolutionary, and that served him very well in the American Revolution and during the French Revolution. But he always kept fighting against the establishment. And when you see the play, you'll understand how that brought him to a somewhat tragic end.
So, Ian, the play feels to me, this one-man show feels like it's playing at two levels, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. One is in the content, right? Who Thomas Paine was in his place in history and the thoughts that he brought forward that affect us yet today. The other was Thomas Paine as a man. And there were two things that struck me about that I want to touch on with you. The first is, in that quote we just played for you, Tom, he says, not an alcoholic. There are a lot of red flags in that play that make me think, are we sure? Are we sure that he wasn't a man who was a victim of his either obsessions or addictions?
Well, I think to some extent he was. He couldn't keep his mouth shut, as Tom just referred to. I mean, he would say the things that everybody else or many people would think but not speak. He was always an outsider. He was, I think, not a particularly easy man to socialize with, to get along with. On the other hand, it's my understanding, and this is always interpretation of history, that he was not an alcoholic. He drank like most men did. He drank his rum and water, or brandy and water, and you couldn't drink water on its own. It would kill you, potentially. So he was not, I don't think he was any filthier than anyone else of the times. So I think the early biographies about Paine, which I started by reading the earliest, and I went chronologically, the earliest ones were vicious against him. Partly, I think, because he disapproved of some of what happened in America in the Revolution. Obviously, his attack on organized religion. He did all these things that enraged a lot of people, but he did them anyway.
So we're having a conversation with Ian Ruskin, the writer and performer of To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, and Tom Patterson, the Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Tom Patterson, I'll turn to you here. We've just been talking parts about Thomas Paine as a man, and I wonder, are all of our founding fathers this complicated and have been washed by history? Or was there something particularly complicated about Thomas Paine?
I think Thomas Paine sort of got washed out of history in a sense, right? Well, if you ask people who the founding fathers were, they would say, well, George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Paine probably wouldn't be on that list. What's interesting is all of those men thought of him in that vein. If you asked Americans as well, who on a, adjusted for the population size, who is the best-selling American author of all time? Tom Paine wouldn't make the list, but he's at the top of the list. I mean, he was extraordinarily influential. Washington, in fact, ordered that some of his words be read aloud to the troops in the field.
And in listening to you, I realize I've been remiss. I should ask, what was the big thing he wrote leading up to the Revolutionary War?
Well, it wasn't his original title, but he accepted it. It was Common Sense.
What was extraordinary about it, and the reason it still remains the bestseller in American history in terms of population, was it said that America should become independent. It said America could win a war against the British Army. It spoke about all kinds of ideas of government and rights. But what it did, he wrote in simple sentences. I've read a lot of Enlightenment writers where the sentences take up a page. And by the time you get to the end, you've forgotten the beginning. He would write very simple things. These are the times that try men's souls. It tells you exactly what he's trying to say. And that's, I think, what made him dangerous, because he could be understood by the masses, by the working people, by the common man, if you like. And that was dangerous in the minds of many of the movers and shakers of the Revolution.
And he had received no royalties off of Common Sense, at least at the beginning. He might have picked up a few pennies later on. But, he was a common man himself. I mean, unlike some of the other great writers of the Enlightenment, that kind of pushed the idea of that change was coming and change was needed. Thomas Paine had an elementary school education. This was not the Oxford-educated John Locke or and so on. You go down the list. This is a common man, and I think he had an uncommon feeling for the common person. I've always found it fascinating. So at the Boston Public Library, I think they have, I was told, they have a copy of John Adams' Common Sense. Now, Adams is one of those people who really didn't trust Paine and really didn't like the message. And in fact, he wrote a rebuttal to Thomas Paine.
So let's hear a little bit more from the play now. This is Ian Ruskin in the filmed version of mm-hmm. To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine.
Well, I continue to write against the Federalists, who were beginning to contemplate government as a profitable monopoly for the support and benefit of the rich at the expense of the general public. And I wrote for deism and for an association of nations and was advised to stop and didn't. I did also compare John Adams to a number of animals and better yet, vegetables.
So, Ian, it's perfect. It's there is this trolling that's happening among and amongst these people that we have for generations referred to as the Founding Fathers. I could picture this going down on Twitter.
Absolutely. And if Paine was here today, he'd be on Twitter. Well, we don't know quite in the last few days, but I'd say he'd be on all kinds of social media 24 hours a day. One thing I want to say when you were about him giving away the rights.
Yes.
It's to me, it's a bit like a lot of bands today will put up music for free on various platforms. And they do that to promote their work.
Yeah.
They also know that you don't really make money out of selling copies anymore. You make money out of live concerts. But Paine was doing the same thing, in a sense. He was putting up his work to be free to everyone because, for him, he wanted everyone to hear it and read it. Maybe he realized it could potentially make him, in a way, immortal in time. But he made no money. In fact, as Tom mentioned, later he made some money, and he gave that to Washington to buy mittens for his men.
So, Tom Patterson, there are moments of back and forth that feel so today and yet so radical, and then so today and yet so radical. Is Thomas Paine a thinker for the ages?
I think so. I mean, what's interesting about Paine, if you read Paine, he's making an arguments that, and this is a century before Karl Marx, he's making arguments about labor and capital, and arguing that we don't respect labor enough and that we ought to organize more of society around labor. And then you can kind of jump ahead to the contemporary period. And many of the arguments you're hearing today about around income inequality and the like, there are echoes all over Paine's writings about income inequality and the problems of income inequality. In fact, he argued that there ought to be something like a guaranteed annual income for every family so that nobody lived in dire poverty. So I think he is a man for the ages. And it's written, you know, almost every passage kind of takes you back and forth in history.
We're speaking with Thomas Patterson of Harvard University and Ian Ruskin, the writer and performer of To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine. I will come back to you, Ian, with a piece of sound that is from the very beginning of the show.
And if you fear a history lesson tonight, what is history for but to remind us of our better dreams? And what is life for but to search for the truth?
That searching for the truth is interesting as one listening to those words, listening to his words throughout the play, and looking at or watching your project as the writer and actor bringing us Thomas Paine. Because there is this moment that we're in where we are reconsidering all the history we've told ourselves about everything from slavery and racism and gender and freedom and who the Constitution was for. And you, as you write this history of Thomas Paine, want us to understand him as someone who had greater clarity of thinking on questions of race, equality, slavery, equal access to the vote, ownership of the means of production, as Tom Patterson was just telling us. I want to believe you, and I also want to question if that is a patina he fully deserves. And I just don't know.
Well, in my mind, he's unique. There isn't anyone else like him in the American Revolution who wrote the way he did. Remember, he also, and this is in the play, he wrote in the French Revolution. He was potentially nearly guillotined. He was nearly hung by the British. He then wrote Age of Reason, which was an extraordinary attack on organized religion, but also the Bible. So he took on...
But not an attack on faith.
not an attack on your right to faith.
Yeah.
He always said, you have the same right to your beliefs as I. He was a deist. Deists believe in a power that created, but they believe that then it's up to the human race to take care of everything. So, but deists believed that if you, whatever your religion was, that was fine, but I had the right to mine. So that was a very, that was quite a radical concept in its, in and of itself.
So Ian Ruskin, I'll turn back to you for my last question, and there's really two pieces to it, which is, as you play this play in Boston, right?
Yes.
Which I would think would be very much like doing it in Philadelphia, for example. What do you want us here to carry away with us about Thomas Paine? And do you feel a particular responsibility in a city like ours and how you bring that lesson forward?
Well, apart from the fact that John Adams is the butt of my best jokes, leaving that aside, and you heard one of them earlier,
yep.
Jokes may be overstating.
I think that's right.
I do think, I mean, I've done this play in Philadelphia more than once. I've done it once before in Boston. Boston, like Philadelphia, those were two of the cradles of the Revolution. And I want particularly those kinds of places and cities to know more about Paine, because Paine had such an impact on the Revolution. And as Thomas said, and as I've said, he's not recognized for that. And I think it's really important that when people go on the Freedom Trail in Boston, Paine's not a part of that, but they need to know somewhere in the back of their minds about Thomas Paine, because he was part of what made all that happen. He was the man more than anyone else who inspired people to stand up for freedom with common sense. So it's I think it's especially exciting to perform this in cities like Boston, Philadelphia. I haven't done Washington, D.C. yet. That's another one to go for. But where there is a great history of the Revolution, and in my mind, sometimes some of the founding fathers are thought of perhaps more fondly than they entirely deserve. As you say, there's a lot of, like, looking at our history again. And Paine's had, he's had all the negative stuff already. I think it's great if the citizens of Boston, although Paine mainly lived either in New York or Philadelphia, that they know about Paine, because his spirit is on that freedom trail. It really is.
That's Ian Ruskin, actor and author of the one-man show To Begin the World Again, The Life of Thomas Paine. Also, Thomas Patterson, the Brad Lee Professor of Government and the Press at the Harvard Kennedy School. You can see the show live tonight at the Boston Public Library at 6 p.m. Thomas Patterson will be giving a live introduction. Ian Ruskin, of course, the star of the show. For more information on how to register to attend or about a virtual showing that will air from November 3rd through the 9th, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.